We'll want to let them know.
Sounds like he did a good job.
All right, I'm going to call to order the House Committee on Business, or excuse me, Consumer Protection and Government Effectiveness. A little Freudian slip there, excuse me, Mr. Chair, from another committee. Good morning, it is, or good afternoon. It is Tuesday, March 17th. Happy St. Patrick's Day. And we have quite a full agenda today, so I'm going to go ahead and start it off. So I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2617. And Representative Holdy, do you want to invite your constituent to the dais as well?
Sure. You want me to go down there?
Yeah, go ahead. And then Wendy will give us a summary of the bill.
Is there anybody to start and then you can call them?
Sure.
Okay. Madam Chair, committee. Thank you for this opportunity to speak to the committee on House Bill 2617. For the record, my name is Paul Holby, State Representative District 8. So I brought this bill forward just in light of some things that we've been seeing in public contracting and some of the contractors that are performing work using our public taxpayer dollars. And sadly, we have a problem with some of the contractors that are being awarded these projects, and they're not complying with some of our most basic laws. Most concerning are our tax laws and our wage laws. And so this bill is really just about putting in place some considerations that contracting agencies should look at when they award contracts for public projects. And in that we're asking that they provide affidavits that they are in compliance with these particular laws, and that means something specific. It doesn't mean that they might owe taxes or that they're remedying a situation. It means that they're not in violation, have outstanding violations. In order to comply with the requirement that the contractor award a subcontractor only to responsible subcontractors. As you may know, a public contract is generally with the contracting agency and a general contractor or a CMGC, and really doesn't have anything to do with the subcontractors. Yet the subcontractors are working on these public projects, getting the benefit of public tax dollars and working on these projects. So we think it's imperative that our contracting agencies, when they look at awarding these contracts, have some sort of assurance that the people that are working on this job, all the contractors working on these jobs, are play by the rules, that they don't cheat, that they pay the wages they're supposed to pay, and they pay the taxes that they're supposed to be paying, and that they don't have a history of that, what I would call cheating, in their past. And so that's why I bring this bill forward. It's it's pretty basic, that we feel that when contractors are performing work with getting the benefit of public dollars, that they don't undermine good contractors who play by the rules, pay good wages, and undermine a local market. We oftentimes see this with out-of-state contractors who come in and have a bad history and are out of compliance in their own state, as well as history in this state of not paying their taxes and not paying the wages that they're supposed to be paying. So this is a basic consideration of making sure these contractors are responsible. And that's simply the concept involved here. And happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Do you want to bring your constituent up as well?
Yeah, I'll probably go back up here.
Okay.
And you can call them.
Or I guess, so do you have any questions for Representative Holvey? And is that Jeff Harms, is that your constituent? Jeff Harms, do you want to come? Please state your name for the record and then proceed.
Jeff Harms, I am from Springfield, Oregon. Good afternoon, Chair Fagan and committee. Thank you for your time today. My name is Jeff Harms. Again, I am from Springfield, Oregon. I represent the Pacific Northwest Regional Council of Carpenters. I am here today to speak in favor of House Bill 2617. I have worked as a carpenter in the Mid-Valley in the Eugene area for 10 years. The last couple years, I've become a representative for the Carpenters Union, and it's in that role that I've been exposed to many of the shortcomings of current prevailing wage law, which prevailing wage law as it's written is very good. It's enforcement that I see that is lacking. I think this bill will help stop some of the shortcomings of enforcement by stopping it at the beginning of the project and in the bid process. I know my time is limited, but I'd like to touch on a few projects that I've been affected in my job. Churchill High School in 2013 was doing an addition to their project or to their school. Baldwin General Contracting out of Albany, Oregon was the general contractor. They subcontracted to a local drywall contractor for the drywall and metal studs on the project. Once that contractor was on site, Baldwin asked to split the contract, let the subcontractor hang the drywall. Their folks would do the metal stud framing. We were contacted by some of their folks that were really just wondering if they were being paid the correct rate. It turns out they were being paid laborer's wages to do carpenter scope work, which in our eyes and in the state's eyes, I believe, is wage theft and misclassification. Baldwin was fined $10,700 for that project. They paid their fine, they paid their workers, and now there is no evidence of that misstep by Baldwin. Baldwin has continued to contract with state agencies for public projects. Since that Churchill project, we have found them hiring subcontractors that were not prevailing wage bonded to do work. They seem to have fixed their own labor issues and misclassification issues and are now expecting their subcontractors to do the work for them. Many times we see a first-tier sublist on a Baldwin public project, and then we get out to visit the job, and those contractors are nowhere to be found. Either they have third-tiered to another contractor or they contracted to an entirely different subcontractor for the project. Another contractor I would like to speak about is Adroit Construction out of Medford, Oregon. We ran into Adroit on a Southern Oregon University project early when I first got this position. We were approached again by workers on the project who didn't feel they were being paid correctly. These folks were actually being paid cash, no overtime. And when you're paid cash, the contractors misstepping tax laws, workers' compensation laws, etc. On that particular project, we helped several workers fill out bully complaints. Those complaints went to bully wage complaints. It's been 2 years since that project has completed, and those workers have not been paid yet. But in bully's investigation of the project, they found that Adroit also publicized the wrong wage rate for the entire project. So every contractor, with the exception of one or two who caught the mistake and paid their employees correctly, every contractor on that project paid their workers incorrectly. And this was, in effect, the result of Baldwin's publishing the correct wage rates for that project, which is another way that, as you all know, these projects are given to the lowest bidder. And this is just another tactic by contractors to become that lowest bidder. Contractors know that the state does not have the resources to monitor every single project. So a lot of times it comes into our court. We visit these jobs as a matter of our business anyways, and a lot of times these issues are brought to our attention. One other project that I would like to speak about is the Capstone project in Eugene, Oregon. This was not a public project. It's not a prevailing wage project. It was a city-sponsored project. It was given, the developer was given 10 years worth of tax breaks to build this project. On this project, all of the contractors, or the majority of the contractors, and I would say the problem contractors, were out-of-state contractors. The general was out of Tennessee, if I remember correctly. The drywall contractor, which was the biggest issue for, in our eyes, was out of Arizona. When they first arrived in Eugene, they were not licensed. They were their license was revoked in their home state of Arizona. They have since reattained that. Their office in Eugene that's listed with the CCB is actually the post office, so they actually don't have an office in Eugene. But again, we were notified about this project because of workers on the job who were being paid cash, no overtime, no breaks. So taxes were not being taken out. Workers' compensation was not included. The violations of X-Wall, which is the contractor in this case out of Arizona, there were safety violations, sanitary violations. The laws that were broken on this project were blatant. They felt that they could continue, even though we've brought this to their attention, continue as is. We also found in this particular case, and I believe in many cases, that these contractors really weigh the risk of breaking these laws. They know that enforcement is not strong. They also know that once the penalties are paid, there's no record of this of their penalties. And so when we talk to end users and public agencies about using these folks, there's no record of it either on the BOLI or the CCB websites. And we're often told we looked into this contractor and there's no issues that we can find. With the Capstone project, and given it was not a prevailing wage project, but that contractor out of Arizona is now doing another project in Eugene, and we just helped six people fill out wage complaints 2 weeks ago. These six folks worked for a month and were never paid. They were working for cash and doing piecework, so there's no record of them ever working there, and the contractor knows that. So those complaints are in the process right now. This same contractor out of Arizona has just picked up another job in Eugene for a local contractor out of Eugene. So they continue to do what they do and break these laws without any consequence. They've paid several fines and just keep going as business. It's a cost of business for them. The effect of these types of contractors on respectable and responsible contractors is significant. Contractors who pay living wages on all of their projects should have an advantage on these public projects because they have the best personnel, because they pay the best wages and the best benefits. But for some reason, when wages and materials are equalized, they are somehow at a disadvantage where you would think they would be at an advantage for those projects. And the reason is because contractors know how to get around the system. And what it does to responsible contractors is it makes them look at ways to also bend the rules to compete. Otherwise, they don't ever get the jobs. In conclusion, I guess my position with the Carpenters Union has really shone a light on the weaknesses of the enforcement of prevailing wage. I think the language in this bill that's being proposed would help stop some of that at the front door rather than chasing it at through the back door. So thank you for your time. Can I take any questions?
Yes, absolutely. Thank you very much for your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Harms, H-A-R-M-S?
Yes, it is.
Mr. Harms? Representative Nierman.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Harms, for your testimony. So when I look at this law here, it looks like the cornerstone of it is kind of the that you're going to have the contractors going to produce an affidavit saying that the subcontractors are in compliance with this, that, and the other thing, right? And it seems to me, if you first of all, I would say, how does the contractor know that the subcontractor's in compliance with all that stuff? And then I'll just get to the chase here. It seems to me like you're just putting a piece of paper in the middle there, which is the affidavit, which is kind of a little bit difficult to get. I think you have to have it notarized, right? Is that right? To get an affidavit, you have to have it notarized? So I'm getting furrows from the lawyers in the group here. But you have to get an affidavit. And I'm thinking, if I'm a shady contractor or something like that, and I'm paying guys cash, and I don't deny that that goes on, or I'm monkeying with the prevailing wages or pay, you know, whatever, something like that, that it's not any problem for me to just produce an affidavit or something like that. So how is this going to have any teeth? How is this going to solve the problem, just producing an affidavit?
Well, Chair Fagan, Representative Nierman, thank you for your question. I think what this bill will do is give more accountability to the general contractors. Many times I come on site and I see who's working on the job site, and I automatically run them to see if they're licensed in the state of Oregon, and then I see if they're bonded for prevailing wage work. And I can't believe how many times I come across contractors that may be licensed. Sometimes they're not even licensed. Sometimes it's a third-tier contractor who's not even known to be on that job. But oftentimes they're not bonded to do prevailing wage work. So that's, in my eyes, the responsibility of the general contractor to vet these subcontractors. And I think making the general contractor accountable for their subcontractors is a huge step and a huge piece of the puzzle. No longer can they say, hey, this is not us, this is them. We had no idea they were part of this and had business practices like this. No longer can they pass the buck, so to speak. Does that answer your question?
Madam Chair, maybe I can help with that a little bit. I believe the bill requires the subcontractors to provide their own affidavit that they're in compliance. And if they find to be lying on that affidavit, they would not be in compliance with their contract. And, you know, the remedies to that are up to the contracting agency. They could probably terminate it or seek some other sort of remedy, I'm sure.
Can I follow?
Just quickly, yeah.
But that's not going to really provide any new remedy then, because if I don't have a bond or whatever, and then the fact that I falsified the affidavit in addition to that is going to put me out of compliance on that. I'm happy with that.
Representative Stark, would you mind with taking the question maybe by email? Because we have a really, really full agenda today, and we have three people that want to testify on this bill before. So I just want to kind of – this one's already going a little bit longer than we were expecting. So
okay.
Is that okay? I'm sure the Representative Holley can get his email address. But thank you very much, Mr. Harms. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
And with that, we're going to have Brian Smith, Rob Bovette, and Mike Eliason, please. And gentlemen, in the interest of time, you guys, it looks like you all have the same position, so if you could just try not to repeat things each other says, because we've got quite the full agenda today. Thank you. Go ahead.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, Mike Eliason representing Associated General Contractors. We represent the commercial construction industry in Oregon, over 900 members, depending on the month. That includes both union and open shop contractors, general contractors and subcontractors, urban, rural, the full gamut. And we try to, maintain a big tent to discuss as many of these kind of issues as we can. And I have to say that this is not a particular issue that's come up, at least in the recent past within our membership. As for specific concerns with this bill, we do believe that this inserts public owners deeply into the general contractor-subcontractor relationship, which courts have consistently held are not public contracts. And the prime contractor is already 100% responsible to the public owner to deliver a quality project, and it's certainly in their interest to hire quality subcontractors. In fact, the prime contractor is always required to furnish performance bonds, guaranteeing delivery to the public owner. We see this as adding additional regulation while providing no particular benefit to the public or the prime contractor. There's already existing language in both statute and rule requiring subcontractors to be properly licensed and bonded, and multiple enforcement mechanisms in place for instance, failure to pay construction debts, including CCB's ability to suspend a contractor's license. In the interest of time, I'll kind of skip some of the other. I know you have a full agenda, but quickly, three points to some of the examples we heard earlier. One, with regard to prevailing wage law, there's no question that the vast majority of prevailing wage errors are simply innocent mistakes, because there's 30 to 40 different trade, schedules. It's exceedingly complex, the prevailing wage laws. So that's one. Two, one of the projects cited was the university system, and I know there's been a lot of debate back and forth the last several sessions on how to bring the university system into the public contracting code, because heretofore they've been outside of the public contracting code. So I just put that just down for the record. And then the third example cited, again, was not a public project, so it's hard to see how that would fit into a bill dealing with the public contracting code. So in the interest of time, I'll stop there.
Good afternoon, Chair Fagan, committee members. My name is Brian Smith, and I'm the purchasing manager for Multnomah County. I'm here today to testify in opposition to HB 2617. In our experience, we've not witnessed the problem it supports to solve. The measure creates additional barriers for vendors and their subcontractors to doing business with public agencies, which are not commensurate with the perceived risks. In Multnomah County, approximately 85% of our public improvement contracts have subcontractors. Many of these subcontracting opportunities are exactly the types of work where we're able to utilize state-certified MWSB firms to help grow and develop their businesses. Our experience is also that vendors are highly motivated to select their subcontractors so they can continue to demonstrate for future work with public employers that they've satisfactory record of both performance and integrity, which are two of the vendor responsibility requirements, which are assessed prior to our awarding contracts to them. In addition to creating additional requirements, the method used in this bill, the affidavit, has added complexity for public agencies to determine vendor responsibility. Prior to last year, the standard for all of the items which enabled a public agency to determine that a vendor is responsible was that they sign a public agency's representations and certifications form, which, in addition to making their bid or proposal a binding legal one, includes the assurances that a public agency needs to help them determine responsibility. Last year, a new requirement for what makes a vendor responsible was added, that they paid their taxes, but it required that the agency submit an affidavit to this effect, the only responsibility requirement that requires an affidavit. The affidavit requires notarization, whereas a representations and certification form only needs to be signed. This tripped up a lot of public agencies over the last year in the implementation of this requirement, and has made the landscape of bidding and proposing for public works more complex for vendors, as they now have different forms with different certification requirements. I hear all the time from vendors that it's difficult to work with public agencies, and as a public purchasing professional, I'm constantly challenging the processes we set up as an agency to ensure that we make it easy and as efficient as possible, but while remaining legally compliant. And I believe this bill brings additional complexity to both vendors and public agencies without significant public benefit, and I urge you not to move it forward. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today, and I'd be happy to address any questions.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Rob Bovet, legal counsel for the Association of Oregon Counties. In the interest of brevity, I'll keep it very short. First point, I just say ditto to what you just heard from the two previous speakers. Second, I would note that many of our members are in severe financial distress, and imposing new burdens on them without much public benefit, really, I would urge you to impose a high standard of proof before you move that type of legislation forward, and that's what we view this as. So we would urge you to oppose this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So quickly, any questions for this panel? Representative Holvey, do you want to kick it off?
Well, certainly. I really appreciate, or maybe I don't appreciate your position, but, you know, I think this bill, you're overstating its burdensomeness. It's an issue where, you know, why do our public agencies allow contractors that cheat to perform work on their projects? And these are adding some very simple things into the determination of what a responsible contractor is. And some of those things are just asking them, the subcontractors included, to provide an affidavit that they are compliant with Oregon's laws. And why our contracting agencies want to allow this shadow industry to exist under the veil of our contract is only with the general and they're, you know, bona fide and they are bonded and licensed. We're asking you to make sure that you get affidavits from the general contractor who's supposed to get affidavits from his subcontractors that they're also licensed, bonded, and are in compliance with the law. That's all this bill does, and the fact that public agencies don't want to stand up to make sure that taxpayers' money is going to legitimate contractors who pay legitimate wages kind of baffles me. So just my statement.
Thank you, Representative Holder. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. I'm looking at the wording on this bill of page 1, starting at about line 9. In determining a subcontractor's responsibility, a contractor shall, and then it goes into a full list of things that this contractor would have to be able to attest to in addition to receiving this affidavit. What sort of a time commitment or burden do you think that would cause for everyday contractors?
Chair Fagan, Representative Stark. I believe that would be a significant burden, but beyond that, it's simply what that is essentially is taking the responsible bidder law that's in place right now for contractors to provide to the public agency and then moving that down in the chain of commerce all the way down through so that every general would have to get that from every subcontractor. But then curiously on the second page, it talks about the general contractor would have no obligation to verify the truth or look behind the affidavit. And so there's just a lot of, for us, we have a lot of questions on how that would all work if there's no enforcement and the subcontractors are already required to be licensed and bonded by law. And again, there's enforcement mechanisms for that. We're struggling to see the value of placing that additional regulation in statute.
Yes, Representative McClain.
I just want to make sure I understand right now what are the counties, what is their enforcement? The first fellow made it sound like there wasn't much in the way of enforcement. So do you have a percentage of contracts that you think you have had to talk about or deal with or problem solve for after your enforcement looked at these contracts?
Chair Fagan, Representative McClain, speaking over kind of a position for this with our facilities folks, and it's mostly the facilities project managers who are dealing with the subs and the generals on the day to day. This hasn't been an issue in terms of the problems that you heard about bad subs earlier on. We haven't had that experience, which is again why while I absolutely sympathize with the sentiment of this bill and that public agencies should absolutely be doing business with vendors who are responsible, the amount of requirements and in terms of what that requires for both our generals, our subs, and our project managers and the public agencies in general to do additional paperwork, additional checks, those kinds of things, that the position that we've taken is that we have a situation here where it doesn't balance out to add lots of additional requirements for a problem that really isn't as we've not seen it as being a significant problem.
Other questions for this panel? Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. So if this bill were to move forward, do you think that it would have a significant impact on minimizing the number of bad businesses out there doing the kind of bad business that we just heard about?
Chair Fagan, Representative Stark, I'm not sure, given that we haven't had at Multnomah County the experience of working with these bad subcontractors, to say a reduction in that, I'm not sure.
Other questions? All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else who'd like to be heard on this House Bill 2617? Okay. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2617. And just to kind of, because we are trying to get through, we have some constituents that are here today. So on House Bill 2375, we're going to save that for the end. I know there are several folks who are here to testify on that. So we'll hopefully get to that today. But since there are other bills involving people who've traveled, we were going to leave that one for the end. So now I'm going to open the public hearing on House Bill 3031 and hand over my gavel to the good vice chair.
All right, so we'll bring up Francis Boyette and Chair Representative Shamia Fagan. And Representative Fagan, we have a really busy schedule today, and so I'd like to ask you to keep your testimony to a minimum. So, should have given it to Bueller.
Okay, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Shamia Fagan, State Representative for House District 51. And I am going to turn it over to my constituent, Frances Boyette, to talk about a particular type of phone call that she received last fall. And then I'll talk about the bill that we're intending to do to remedy it. So,
good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Frances Boyette. I live in Clackamas. I'm in House District 51, where Representative Fagan is our fearless leader. I'm come to you with bare hands. I don't have any pieces of long paper to tell you. I just want to tell you about the irritation of the election last year when we were inundated by call upon call upon call of automated nature, asking the same questions over and over and over again. The first couple of times, it's kind of cool when this recorded voice wants your answers, and you press number one, and then you press number two, and this is kind of... When it gets to time four and five, it's not funny anymore. When it gets to the point where they have got absolutely no consideration for the time of day, that's not funny anymore either. And the closer it came to election time, the more those calls kept coming. If these were people I were talking to, I could, in a very courteous way, say, you know, really, I've answered your questions. Do you mind? I'm going to hang up. And every time, I guess it's just our inquisitive nature, you answer the phone and you say, oh, maybe this time they've got something different to say. No, it was the same old thing over and over again. As a recipient of these calls, a trillion billion, and especially when you've already kind of, excused my expression, pledged your allegiance, it gets, when they're trying to change your opinion or change your mind, and it was just got to the point where it wasn't funny anymore. So my request is that we have some sort of a way in which, if I have already answered these questions, that I have the ability to opt out if I don't want to continue the call. I can opt out, and towards the end I did by just simply putting the phone down. But I realize that the people that are doing this and the people that are behind those calls, my input is important to them too. So the other option would be is for whoever is initiating these calls and whoever is running these automated calls to have some sort of system in place where if they identify the number, these people have already answered our questions, we don't call them anymore. That's it in a nutshell.
Thank you very much. So this problem came to my attention with another constituent. The first I heard of it was a woman named Cynthia Smith, who couldn't be with us today, but she asked me to read an email that she sent to me on October 9th of 2014. She said, in the past 24 hours, I've received 10 phone calls from, and then she listed the number on my home line. I've received a similar call on my office line. You can imagine how disruptive and enraging this is. The survey has no means of talking to a real person or opting out of this or future surveys. Just constantly calls back, regardless of whether or not you answer the previous call. I normally participate in surveys, but this has become ridiculous, and I consider it harassment. So that morning, which was October 9th, which you'll notice about still a month before the election, these calls were going on, and I put something on Facebook saying, hey, this is not us, you know, sorry that this is happening. And other people commented, just a few of the comments from Facebook. The robot is driving our home crazy. They're calling me 3 times a day. There's no way to get off this call list. And then somebody said, is this legal in Oregon? Someone should record these calls and report it to the Oregon Department of Justice. So obviously, upon my reelection, I looked into this. Now, obviously, you know, people have the opportunity through the First Amendment to do the outreach that they want during a campaign. But the problem is that, as is indicated by Ms. Boyette's testimony and then the emails, is there was no option to opt out. And people, I heard from constituents who said, we literally unplugged our phone for several weeks because literally they would just call you in the evening, late at night. It was just this automated call. So the simple solution that we've come up with, that we've worked with legislative counsel to make sure that it's constitutional, is actually the -1 amendment to House Bill 3031. Which simply provides that for these robocalls, that they require that within the first 10 seconds of the call, that there be an option of a single dual tone multi-frequency signal, i.e., you know, to opt out of future calls, push 2. And that once a person has selected to opt out of future calls, that they basically become part of the do not call list for that number. And so that's a simple solution that we've come up with. I guess there's a similar legislation already in place to regulate these types of kind of non-sales but still kind of automated calls to consumers or to people in our community, to Oregonians. And so this would just be one addition to require a single touchtone opt-in. As you heard from Ms. Boyette, these calls are already asking for a touchtone comment, and so they certainly have the option to make sure that somebody can opt out of future calls so that people aren't being harassed by their own phone line, not being able to actually use their phone and having to unplug their phones during election season or whenever else, because this bill is not specifically targeted to political calls. It can't be because of the First Amendment. So this applies to all of these kind of automated type robocalls to give people the option to opt out of that call with a simple push tone button so that they can be taken off the list if they so choose. So that's the -1, which should be on OLIS. With that, I will be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Rayfield. Why not just do the national do not call registry to begin with? Wouldn't that satisfy the issue completely instead of just having a bill for these to change how the robocalls are done, instead just opt out of all of these types of calls?
Can I answer that?
Sure.
I would just like to tell you that national no-caller list is about as worthless as gum under my shoe.
Fair enough.
I don't think I have anything to add to that.
Representative Bueller.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I'm supportive of the concept. Question for Chair Fagan. Would you also support accurately and truthfully identifying people who are paying for political ads on TV?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Vice Chair, I certainly do support that. I don't know that that's not exactly the target of this bill, but I definitely support that. We actually tried in this bill, in the initial draft, to require the caller to identify on behalf of whom they're calling. The First Amendment, there was a bit of a First Amendment issue there in what they called compelled speech. Legislative Council asked us to back off of that part because you know, not only can you not prohibit speech under the First Amendment, you also can't compel certain speech. So they felt like that was probably constitutional, but probably walked the line a little bit more closely. And the reality is, again, this bill applies generally to all of these calls. Nothing, we're not targeting political calls specifically, but in the political realm, you know, I just don't know if it would solve that much of a problem because anybody can set up a PAC called the I Love America PAC. And so they said, oh, paid for by the I Love America PAC. I don't know how much information that gives consumers, but I certainly am supportive of any, you know, kind of campaign transparency, et cetera. I'd love to make these calls identify themselves. That's in the original draft. But again, Legislative Council asked us to take it or recommended that we take it out because of the concerns of compelled speech under the First Amendment.
We'll do one last follow-up. Representative Stark.
Thank you, Chair Rayfield. Chair Fagan, just to double check, I may have misheard you. I thought you referenced the Dash 1 amendments. We only have Dash 3 amendments in here. Are they one and the same? So the amendments that we have in here, the Dash 3, are the ones that you're speaking of?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rayfield, yes. Sorry, I only filed one amendment, so I think of it as the Dash 1. But as you can tell, we worked with Legislative Council closely and the Attorney General's office to try and come up with something very simple, very workable, and very enforceable. And so the Dash 3, I correct my testimony, the Dash 3 are the amendments that are kind of what we're working from.
All right. And with that, is there anybody else that would like to testify on this bill? Okay. Seeing none, we'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 3031.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thank you. We'll turn the gavel back over to Chair Fagan. Okay. And which one do we want? Are we just going 29? 29, 25, and 34. Stand at ease for a moment.
...25 and House Bill 3248. And so we'll have the representative from the Oregon Rehabilitation Association come up and the representative from SEIU as well. Ross Ryan, I think it's us. Yes. You are rejecting St. Patrick's Day green with a vengeance.
I am.
I like that. I'm not wearing green, and you can all see it. So. Very cool. We'll go ahead and introduce yourself and proceed. Thank you.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Fagan and committee members. My name is Chris Burnett. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. Won't go into all of who that is because I think we've been talking a lot lately. So I think you know that we represent community providers from across Oregon who provide services to individuals with disabilities. I'm here to take a neutral position on House Bill 2925. And 2925 takes the most measured approach, in our opinion, on all of the QRF bills that are being considered by the legislature this session. Although it would affect fewer people, we still have some concerns that individuals with significant disabilities might lose jobs and QRFs might lose contracts as a result. Why we are taking a neutral position is because this bill has a smaller scope, unlike Senate Bill 555, which would impact about 500 individuals. 2925 would impact about 100 individuals, so it lessens the scope a little bit. But what our we still have concerns in that the rural regions are more reliant on productivity-based wages, and that there might be an undue, risk of job loss in that area as their prices will go up, and could have a significant impact. And that DAS has little authority over the political subdivisions in the rural areas regarding QRF contracts. DAS is already stretched very thin. As far as ensuring compliance, they are operating at near capacity, but at half the staff that they used to have. This adds another layer of oversight that puts additional pressure on DAS and reduces the amount of time available to advance the program and purposes of the QRF program. Similar to the executive order, QRFs are already incentivized to pay minimum wage in community jobs as part of the governor's executive order, where that is incentivized. House Bill 2925 takes a more regulatory approach. To reiterate that the 2925 is the more moderate of all the QRF bills being considered by the legislature. Nonetheless, we encourage careful consideration of revisions made to a program that has been supported individuals with disabilities well and been successful. So I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
Okay, and I think since you guys are presenting different bills, I think we will actually do questions for Runyon, is that your last name?
Burnett.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, I see. I got it down here. Of Ms. Burnett, and then we'll go to Ms. Hagan's testimony. Is there any questions for Ms. Burnett? Okay, thank you. Go ahead, Felisa.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Felisa Hagans. I'm the political director of SAIU 49. I believe you have my testimony submitted, so I won't read the whole thing for you. We're here in support of House Bill 3248. We've introduced this bill. SAIU 49 represents about 600 workers who work at a qualified rehabilitation facility. And we feel that although the program has been successful at employing people with disabilities, it's time to move it into the direction of a new generation where it's about supported employment, but it's also an issue of fairness when it comes to disabled workers and their ability to earn a living. House Bill 328 addresses some serious problems regarding employee wages, accountability, oversight, worker retention, and some concerns that we have with local government opt-outs. So I know that last week the committee heard testimony about the program. I'm sorry, I wasn't here for that. I was very ill. So I won't go over all of those pieces again. But House Bill 248 directs QRFs to pay wages that meet or exceeds the rate set by the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries, or a prevailing wage. On the accountability and oversight mechanism, there's an audit provision. We like Bully to audit QRF similarly to how they have an audit for other industries to ensure that prevailing wages and wage and hour laws are being followed. I think two challenges in this area with QRFs. One challenge is it's a low barrier to entry industry. And so when people often will start a small business, there'll be mistakes made, and that will impact workers' wages and benefits greatly. The audits by Bully will help prevent those mistakes being made. And then there's obvious, there's just some bad apples who, frankly, will take advantage of this population and short them on their wages and benefits. And so finding those early on is important. And we have found that working with disabled workers to walk them through the wage and hour violation process with the Bureau of Labor and Industries has been a challenge. It's not set up, actually, for people with disabilities to able to start and finish the process when it comes through wage and hour complaints. So we believe this bill will help rectify some of that. The bill also includes a worker retention provision, so that if QRF contractors change over, that it doesn't negatively impact the workers and they're allowed to retain their jobs if the contract is turned over through no fault of their own. So oftentimes governments will change a contractor or for a variety of reasons. They want a different level of cleaning, a QRF is going out of business, et cetera. These workers then get to retain those jobs or get what we call first right of refusal, so that there isn't turnover or change with the workers directly. And so it allows to do that. This is also a provision that is often in federal contracts. So the federal government has this worker retention for all workers, actually, in these types of service contracts. It just helps create stability, helps reduce turnover, and actually helps government save money in retraining and costs, and there's no disruption of services. The final piece is an agency opt-out piece. Right now, if you are a local government or a state government, you put out a request for a proposal and there's a QRF who's able to do the job, you must contract with a QRF. This option gives you the option, if the QRF doesn't meet the standards, especially the employment standards, that you can opt out to a non-QRF, but you must retain the workers. We feel like it's very important for disabled workers to not only keep their jobs, but also be mainstreamed into full employment in other areas and venues. And if disabled workers have been providing that work already, it's clear that they can perform that service. And so even if you're going to go with a non-qualified rehabilitation facility, we believe that those workers should be able to retain their jobs. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Questions, Representative Buehler.
Do you have an estimate of how much wages would increase with this?
That's, Chair Fagan, Representative Buehler, that's a good question. It would vary, actually. And so for the workers that we represent, wages wouldn't increase at all. So for some of the QRFs, work, the wages could increase. You know, we've heard through various committee hearings last session and this session, some say that it could increase 115% because people are making that much below the minimum wage. Some folks, it will stay the same. Mm-hmm. And we've asked several times to try to figure that out.
Other questions, Representative McLean?
I think the only question that I have is, and trying to put together last meetings and this meeting, you know, and everything that we heard, and there were so many different types of facilities, and there were some facilities that, you know, there were 21 out of 49 that had these characteristics and so forth. But when you're talking about, especially this 3248, and we just heard testimony that the other one would only possibly affect, you know, maybe a fourth. Does this affect everybody? Does it affect everybody who's in the system working now?
Chair Fagan, Representative McLean, it does not affect everybody who's in the system working now. The 14C workers who are part of the sheltered workshops who you heard about last week are not included in this bill. But this bill does have the largest impact as per number of workers.
Other questions?
Chair Fagan, I know Representative Stark's office had sent me an email with a list of questions. I sent him a response to those questions quickly. But if there are other questions that people have, I know over the last couple of days of these hearings, other questions may come up. Please just feel free to email or call me.
Thank you.
And yes, Chair Fagan, I will have my staff send that on to the whole committee.
Send it to Wendy and then she can send it
Wendy.
To us.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. Great. Thank you both very much.
Chair. Can I ask something? I was planning to testify on 3248, as is Josh Bierman. Do you want me to just come back?
Felisa, why don't you go ahead and sit down, and then, yeah, you can have Josh come up with you on 3248, and we'll try and kind of alternate. There's a lot of folks that just want to testify on both, so it cuts down a little bit at the time, but go ahead.
Okay. So, you know who I am. Thank you.
Yeah, actually, do reintroduce yourself since you're not testifying
on
a different bill, though.
My name is Chris Burnett, and I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Rehabilitation Association. And we are testifying in opposition to 3248. 3248 unnecessarily singles out QRFs for burdensome oversight and straps agencies that contract with QRFs with additional red tape and cost. It is the most drastic of all the QRF bills considered by the legislature this session, and takes requiring not just minimum wage but prevailing wage on all QRF contracts. Again, our concern is always with the workers with the most severe disabilities, especially those in rural regions. It singles out the QRFs who are already subject to BOLI oversight and a lot of other oversight, the Department of Labor, IRS. There are a lot of entities that have oversight authority over QRFs, and there is no evidence that we've been able to find from BOLI's own data that indicate that there are a tremendous number of outliers or bad actors or people that are not complying with the system. Under House Bill 3248, agencies would be required to track literally hundreds of individual QRF contracts. Not only is this expensive, it creates an administrative headache for the QRF program, and the QRF program relies on the goodwill of public agency contracts, and this might be a hindrance to the work that they do. And to be really blunt, this bill seems clearly designed to benefit the largest QRF in the state and who holds nearly half of all the sales volume in the QRF program. It's really a thinly veiled attempt to raise the prices of QRFs that compete with PHC for contracts in the Portland metro area. It is unfairly singles out QRFs for our oversight and adds confusing and unnecessary administrative burdens to the contracts, and that is our concern with the bill. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. And before you come, Tim
Rochek,
you can go ahead and come up and be the third panelist. Thank you. Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Fagan. Thank you, committee. My name is Josh Bierman. I am the division manager for the QRF program of TVW, and we are the janitorial division, Sustainable Cleaning Systems. I'm here today in support of the smaller to medium-sized QRF organizations that work in Oregon. And to somewhat echo, but not too much, what Chris has already said, is the creation of a policing task force to look over this great program, to me, seems like an undue and unwarranted burden on local government, on the program itself. In the end, that policing task force would become another layer of oversight for a program that's already heavily mandated and has to go through different audits by, you know, the IRS and through our own state program with DAS. Another thing I'd like to mention is that every QRF is different. So to say that you would have one wage or one minimum wage for everyone or prevailing wage for everyone may benefit a larger organization due to their efficiencies of scale. A large organization's overhead is going to be much smaller than a small organization or a rural organization. And if they were to go up for the same contract, there is a possibility that the larger organization could have a price-based advantage. And I think that's something that you guys need to look at when you look at this bill. It could provide an advantage to very large or larger organizations. Thank you.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak. My name is Tim Rochek. I'm the CEO of Garten Services. We have three branches in Salem, Oregon, a branch in Eugene, Oregon, and a branch in Dallas, Oregon. We provide services to approximately 500 people with significant disabilities each year. I'm here to testify against this bill, and I don't want to mix up the bill number because I got a little confused when we were calling people up, but it is the same bill, 3248. I apologize. I should have had that written down.
Okay.
I want to focus on a different piece of this. I will testify later about my concern for people with severe disabilities. Certainly, I have that concern about this bill as well. But I want to bring out a point that doesn't seem to have been illustrated. Almost all of the conversation around this bill and similar bills is really directed about custodial services. That seems to be most of the conversation. That was the origin of the bill when we had a BOLI work group to discuss these issues, and some of the representatives of the unions were there. They were concerned about one bad actor in the Portland area, and my understanding is that's the genesis of these bills. So there was a custodial outfit that was a QRF in Portland who hit the news with Willamette Week. I want to tell you that that's one program in 40 years of this happening. So I want to make the second point that paying, eliminating productivity-based wage or guaranteeing that we pay at least minimum wage to folks primarily in the custodial business, as an example, people with disabilities that are through QRFs working on custodial contracts. There are very few people in Oregon who are people with disabilities who are paid sub-minimum wage on custodial contracts. I don't know if you know that or not. The people I'm concerned about at Garten, we have a large custodial business. We do not have anybody who is working in custodial who is paid sub-minimum wage in custodial. Whether you know it or not, custodial is not easy work. It's not an easy work for somebody with a cognitive disability. It's hard to place people with significant disabilities successfully doing a state office or a federal office building where you have to judge clean through somebody else's eyes. It's a very fast-paced, hard work. Why I tell you that is the focus is on that, but this bill will go way beyond that, and it will require that we eliminate productivity-based wages for people with really severe disabilities that work in other areas in our organizations. For example, some of the people that I serve under state QRF contracts is in our recycling contract. Garten holds the original recycling QRF contract back from 1974. We've been successfully employing people since 1974 recycling state government and other government entities' products. That's a no-pay, no-charge contract. We use the value of the material to offset the labor cost to be able to provide that service for the state. We have 150 to 160 people working on that contract from its origin in 1974. 80% of that labor is done by people with severe disabilities. These are not the people you're picturing. We're talking about people that, and forgive me, I really hate to do this. My whole career, I've been talking about the capability of people with disabilities, trying to sell that and promote that. But I've got to tell you, not everybody can do that work. So we have people who use wheelchairs, who need help in the bathroom, who cannot speak, who may not be able to sign, who have life-threatening seizures. These folks are working. But if you require us to pay minimum wage, that's going to increase the cost of their labor. If somebody's producing, Francis, who is 70 years old, who's worked for us for 40 years, who uses a wheelchair, who has limited use of her right hand, she's going to produce about 10 or 15% of the standard rate. If we're having to pay all of the Francis's minimum wage or better, the cost to that service goes beyond what the customer is willing to bear typically. So I want you to understand, don't picture the custodians that you see driving to work. There are folks that we serve that don't have the ability to toilet themselves that are working today that will stand to lose their job if this bill passes. Thank you very much.
Questions for this panel? Yes.
Thanks, Chair Fagan. Can you define PHC? I'm not familiar with the
Portland Rehabilitation Center.
Okay, thank you.
Other questions? I'm just curious. I mean, this is a concept I'm very new to. So since you were giving specific examples of specific workers, can you give us an idea of how much you're paying per hour those workers, kind of the lowest paid employees in your facility are making how much per hour?
Chair Fagan, members of the council committee, I don't have that information available. I really can't tell you. What I can tell you is that we do everything we can to increase individuals' pay. And then also there was testimony about rules. We are regulated very closely by the Department of Labor. I recently went through, our organization went through a four-month audit from the Department of Labor, and it's not simple to pay people sub-minimum wage. We're very closely regulated. Among regulation, not only have I gone through a Department of Labor audit, BOLI oversees us, SAFE, our insurance, direct insurance carrier, workers' comp, the Federal Source America program, the President's Commission for Employing People with Disabilities has been out to audit me. Our own auditor, we do a direct labor audit specific to this program. So I don't have the numbers for you, but what I can tell you is we take payment very seriously and we are watched very closely in how we do that. We must pay according to the prevailing wage, but we're allowed to adjust it for the individual's productivity.
Chair, if I may, I also like to answer that. Josh Berman again. I would just like to also state that this was a janitorial problem when it started, and we do janitorial in the Portland area. All of our employees make between $10.50, $13, $14, $15 an hour, depending on what they do. This can be a problem, though, to state that everybody should pay the exact same amount of prevailing wage, because then there's no uniqueness in a program. There's no ability for a smaller organization to grow large. You know, a smaller organization may have an overhead of 26%, where a large organization could have an overhead of 8%. That is a huge difference in efficiencies when you're sitting down to go for a contract with the same municipality. So looking at the math, I think, is also important on this bill, and I think it should be looked into closely. Thank you.
When you guys say, just so because we're clarifying, when you say this bill, you're talking about 3248.
3248.
Okay,
thank you.
Yes, Representative.
I had a question for Mr. Rochek. Did I pronounce the name correct?
Yes, wonderfully.
Okay.
He seems surprised.
How many people do you employ?
We employ approximately 400 people.
Okay, follow up. And of those 400 people, how many of those would you classify as what you're calling severely disabled, or that you pay substandard wage? Substandard being below the minimum wage.
It could
be
as many as 100.
Okay.
In any given pay period. And just to be clear, those are not all employees with disabilities. When I say 400, the majority definitely is. But we pay more minimum wage and above than we do sub-minimum wage.
Thank you.
Other questions, Ms. McLean?
I'm trying to remember again from the last meeting. Nonprofits? Everybody's a nonprofit. I mean, everybody in this category.
Correct.
Okay.
To be a QRF, you must be a nonprofit.
Yeah. So I guess that the numbers thing is, I think, important. And so I'm hoping that that maybe you can get information to the administrator or to the committee that really talks about overhead costs and what you think that would change in the way of overhead costs for your organization to stay whole. And two or three of you doing that would be really helpful.
Thank you.
Representative Grayfield.
So, and I guess I have kind of two questions. So there's about 100 people making under the minimum wage. If let's say House Bill 3248 does pass, and you're required to increase your wages, how many people will you lay off?
Chair Fagan, Vice Chair Rayfield, thank you for the question. We have not done those calculations because each bill has slightly different nuances, so we're trying to see the dust settle a little bit more before we play out all those scenarios. There is a piece that would allow us to increase our prices to recover that cost. We think that's going to be a short-term fix because we believe our customers will react negatively to that, and we will see our contracts diminish. So some of that's going to be a slow death. But we believe that clearly people that are in our organization who produce at less than 50% of the normal range, if we can't find a job that eliminates that disability as a key factor in their productivity, all of those folks will lose their job. In my recycling division, I can estimate that out of 150 employees, probably 50 of those folks would lose their job because of the need to pay them a full wage when they're really only producing about a quarter of the full work.
Yeah. And so how many of those 100, you had said 100 folks were under, that were paying a substandard wage, so of those 100, at least 50 of those 100 would be potentially lost, is what you're saying?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And then the...
If I may, why it's difficult to estimate that, we process about 1 million pounds of recyclables across our floor in Salem every week. Mm-hmm. And those recyclables come in from state offices, they come in from delivery trucks, they come in from the curbside collection that your garbage hauler does, and we have a 100,000 square foot warehouse where people process that material along with electronics and other things. To simply raise the wage for the individuals with disabilities who work on state contracts would require us to segregate 1 million pounds of material a week by who brings it to us. It's not a practical thing for us to do. That would be more expensive than raising the wages. And so we'd have to figure out what that really means. We know our private customers would not incur that cost.
My last follow-up.
Last one, thank you.
Yeah, is, and the other thing is, being someone who's on the outside looking in, as I see, is in a competitive market where people are trying to compete for prices, it almost seems like to me there's an incentive to try and manipulate the system to get the lowest possible wages to make you, not necessarily you, but whoever that person is, to have the most competitive product pricing. Is it, I mean, you're in the industry and you guys are around that. I'm curious if that is something you've seen, or I might just be reading into things as well. So,
well, I thank you for the question, Representative Rayfield, members of the committee, and Chair Fagan. I suppose we have a mission that really gets in the way of that. So we're about trying to help people earn as much as they possibly can, and we have outcomes reports that we submit to the State Office of Developmental Disability Services that indicates what people are earning, how many hours they work, and what their service outcomes are. So there are checks and balances there. And simply put, the regulation is such, if there were an edge to be gained by getting a bunch of 14C certificates and paying people less, a lot of people would be doing it. Very, very, very few employers are interested in doing that because it's really a pain in the butt. It requires a lot of documentation. We have a full-time compliance accountant that does nothing but review disability documentation and make sure that we're following the Department of Labor regulations properly. That's a full-time position in our organization that most businesses would not incur.
Thank you. And last question, Representative Holdy.
Thanks. I'm still trying to get my, I've been talking about this for a long time, still trying to get my head around some of the issues involved. And just, you know, getting back to the notion that people will lose their jobs if you had to move from 14C to the minimum wage, the subminimum wage to a minimum wage. Because I'm a little confused about the product and disability law that this bill talks about, public contracting. And so I guess you're assuming that local government, state government, would no longer use your services if you had to pay minimum wage. And I thought that that particular set of statutes wasn't really based on low bid per se. So I'm trying to balance that those two elements out, because this bill's about public contracting, and there's a public contracting preference that I don't think is based on the lowest bid as such. They set aside some preference for QRF, qualified rehabilitation facilities. So I'm trying to connect the dots of why that necessarily means you'll be losing jobs. Because you're saying, I guess you're assuming that you will lose these contracts with government. Am I missing something here?
Representative Holvey, Chair Fagan, I'd be happy to take a stab at that. Yes, we are assuming that to some extent. And then, as I described, again, some of those contracts are clearer what the impact would be than others. And so, as an example, in the recycling division, it isn't going to be limited to just raising rates for a public customer. It isn't as simple as we will now charge the state for the recycling that we do if the state's willing to pay that. We would have to get that same agreement from our other customers, which includes counties, universities, Oregon State University, as an example. I don't believe they will. The law does require them to purchase from a QRF if the product is suitable and the entity has a need. It does go beyond state. The state QRF administrator has been very clear that he has no enforcement capability over political subdivisions that the state cannot make. So our remedy is to sue our customer in that case. In my experiences, and I will use custodial as an example because it's a good one, if you use the law to get a customer to do business with you, there's good reason for the law. The law gets us in the door and gets us a chance to prove that people with disabilities can do a good job. So I certainly support that law continuing. However, if you've really leveraged heavily a legal reason for somebody to have to do business with you and they're not satisfied or the price is too high, they can find ways to get out of doing business with you. It's as simple as your quality isn't good enough. So if my price is too high and let's say, what's a county I don't do business with? Jackson County decides that they don't want to pay 30% more for custodial services because we had to raise our costs due to the labor increase. They can enter into an agreement with us and decide that our quality isn't good. And then that becomes a reason to contract with somebody else.
Thank you very much. So, you're going to get us those numbers on, though, and if you both could, just so we can kind of know what range of salaries we're talking about. And while you're at it, could you also provide kind of the range of executive salaries? Because I know that you're nonprofits, but it doesn't mean there aren't executives paid. I mean, well, you know, Goodwill is always the kind of bad example that everyone gives about, you know, using sub-minimum wage workers, and yet I think they have the highest paid CEO in the country and nonprofits. So if you'd provide kind of your range of wages and then also kind of maybe the top 10 percent or, you know, kind of the top 10 executive salaries too, just so we can kind of look at those things in conjunction. But you can obviously do that after, because I assume you don't have that.
We'd be happy to do that. And also I want to offer, since we are based in Salem, if any of you would like to tour and see real people doing real things and get a sense yourself of the level of disability and the kind of work and what those issues are, we're happy to host a tour.
Thank you very much, and thank you for your testimony. Okay, next up I'm going to call Ross Ryan, Jared Gunther, and Mark Richman.
And Madam Chair, I don't know if the DAS or the procurement officer is signed up to speak on this issue. Probably not.
I don't see DAS, no.
I'll ask offline. I'm very curious how the procurement law would lose jobs.
So all you need to do is just state your name for the record and proceed in whatever order you guys want.
I guess I'll go ahead.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee, my name is Riley Newport, and I'm an advocacy coordinator with the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities. Today I will be supporting Ross in his testimony in support of Senate Bill 3248, and we will be using question and answer for his testimony.
Okay. And my name is Ross Wayne. I speak to you on bill on
forty-eight,
and I'll be speaking on behalf of the OSAC committee, which is a statewide 18 small groups. And we join ourselves all together to make a stronger voice. And we've been working heavily on the employment things.
Great. So, Ross, why is it important to have a job in your community?
It's important to have a job in the community so we can show people what we can do. And so we can pay taxes and to show us we want to fit in.
Why is the community better when people with disabilities are working in their community?
We have the same interest, and we have a lot of passion and dedication into working where we want to be in our field.
What is your job now?
My job is a paid advocate. I am on several committees, like a consecutive order on the employment. And I'm a part of the governor's appointed position on the Medicaid board. And I'm on other committees.
So, expanding a little on your job, what are your duties of your job?
My duties is gathering the information and taking some notes, and then taking the notes back to the statewide group, to OSAC, and back to the DD Council.
All right. So, you've worked in a sheltered workshop, but now you work in the community. How is it different?
Sheltered workshop is we mainly sitting around waiting for work. Depending on the day, it might be an hour or two, and the rest we're sitting around twiddling.
So, talking a little more about sheltered work, some people with disabilities are paid less than minimum wage because of their disability. What do you think sub-minimum wage says about how we value people with disabilities?
It sounded like they are following us as second class, like everybody's up here and we're way down here. And we are trying to say we want to be like everybody else. So we might have different needs, but treat us like everybody else.
So how does this make you feel?
It kind of makes me feel like we aren't appreciated. That they're trying to say because we have a disability, and that they think we need to be treated specially, which we don't.
Now that you are working in the community, why is minimum wage or better important in your life?
So I could go to movies and have fun and go on vacations and pay my taxes that I have a right to pay.
So what supports do you need to do your job?
Transportation, organizing when I'm at my meetings, and going over my calendar for the week, and making sure that my nuts are in order.
Although you're already working, why should an employer hire you?
I'm dependable on time, and I have the passion for the skills that I wanted to do.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Testimony in support of House Bill 3248, Chair Fagan.
I just want to interrupt you. Make sure to state your name for the record.
Okay, members of the community. For the record, my name is Jared Genther. I'm an SEIU Local 49 member, and I work in janitorial for PHC Northwest, which is QRF here. I have worked for them for the past 3.5 years, and prior to that, I've worked for a different QRF called Diversified Abilities. As a janitor for about 1.5 years. I think House Bill 3248 is very important for non-union QRF workers because due to my experience with this specific company, Diversified. The way several of us were getting paid was quite the experience. We were getting paid, with draw checks, several times. What it means is that we got money that was got part of the money for a check and an IOU, basically an IOU for the rest of the money. Then the rest of the money would come later, which wasn't in a favor for not only myself but fellow other workers financially. And I know under the laws of bully, companies are supposed are required to pay workers on time and paid in full, in the proper timely manner. I once filed a complaint with bully, which was a slow and hard process. Not all the workers bothered to file a complaint because of how hard it was, time consuming wise. But some of us did file individually. But before Bully could process our complaint, they said it could take up to 6 months. At least within that time period, we did get our money later. So a lot of us didn't bother pursuing with the full complaint. So basically, the draw check situation would happen to us, later on, it would start to happen to us about every month or so. We would get a pay stub every other week, but we would only get our money once a month. And getting our paycheck would also move around, which would be an inconvenience with us, travel wise. So this type of draw check or IOU, of course, has never happened with the current company I work for, PHC. I'm not saying it happens everywhere, but in support of this bill, I think it would help weed out bad actors. And I hope you guys be in support with this bill.
Thank you very much.
That's it.
Chair Fagan, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Mark Richmond. I'm an executive board member for SEIU, Local 49. I work as a janitor at the Airport for Port and Rehabilitation Center, which is a QRF. I've worked at the airport and for PHC for 13 years. And there are a few people who have been there longer than I have. Just on day shift, there are 8 people that have worked there longer. There are over 100 janitors at the airport, and only about 2 of them aren't disabled. I think House Bill 3248 is really important for non-union QRF workers. At PHC, we have many of the protections outlined in the bill, and I think they could benefit other workers. I have worked besides these people when I was on light duty. And they don't always produce a lot, but they work hard. And I can't see how anybody can say, well, he put that many pieces. I mean, there's 35, 40 people working. They're told what to do. There's one supervisor. How is one supervisor going to say, well, so-and-so put out this much? I mean, that whole thing just asks for abuse. And I know it happens. And I can't say it happens at PHC, but I know it happens. I have worker retention at my job. If another union contractor took over for PHC, we would be able to keep our jobs and our seniority. Nobody likes change. When you're doing something and you're doing it well, why change? It's bad for the customer, it's bad for the company, it's bad for you. I'm a steward at the airport and have been for 12 years. That means I've worked with my union and have specialized training to help people resolve workplace issues. I've worked with a lot of my coworkers over these years, and I think without the help of our union, it would be very difficult for me or my coworkers to file a wage and hour complaint with BOLI. And I have hours of training and experience doing it. I think this bill would help other workers, many of who have disabilities, to make sure they are paid. Finally, I make prevailing wage in the Portland market. Because of my union company pays me over $13 an hour, I have health care paid and a small retirement, not a great big retirement. I go to work every day, and I work just as hard as any worker, regardless of my disability. And I think workers deserve to make prevailing wage or minimum wage if they work. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel?
Thank you.
Mr. Ryan, I'll just note that I think you're the only person to ever testify in the Capitol who says he wants to, he likes to pay his taxes. So that's it's a great testimony. We may use that a lot.
We got to start promoting it.
Yes, hey, I like that. That's good.
I do have a question.
Yeah.
Thank you, Chair Fagan. My apologies. I fell in the middle. We spoke earlier, and I forgot your name, if you'll remind me.
Jared.
All right. Jared, I'm interested about one of the comments you made regarding the draw check, and I heard a little bit about this last week, and we also talked about this earlier today.
Said you heard a similar story last week.
Yes. And if you'd clarify, it's kind of a two-part question. In those times, and I understand you shared with me earlier today about the challenges of having to go to different locations to get the paycheck. I'm frustrated to hear about those things. But on the draw check specifically, my understanding of a draw is that it's usually done by employers that their plan is to only pay you one time a month. And, you know, I mean, the state oftentimes pays employees one time a month. And in order to help tide you over to that one time a month, they would give you a draw check, a smaller amount, usually agreed on, to help you get to that. Was that the case in these scenarios, or were you not even getting paid your full wages?
Well, some of them were like you just mentioned, mm-hmm. but there were several others, and like the one I mentioned the most specifically, the one I mentioned specifically it wasn't the case. You know, okay. For example, during one of our paydays, we involuntarily received, you know, unexpectedly received, you know, a draw check for a certain portion of money. I guess the employer said it was due to, you know, some sort of bank account related issues. I'm not fully aware of the details, but then we received the next portion, you know, about a week later.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification for me. Appreciate it.
Other questions for this panel?
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. Okay. So just as a quick announcement, House Bill 2375 is going to be put off till next week. Sorry for those who are waiting around. We want to make sure we get through this full, and we've got probably two more partial panels. So first we'll have Charles Edelton, and then Terry Marsh. Are you, well, where's Terry Marsh? Are you, you didn't indicate, are you for, against, or neutral? Okay, you can go ahead and come up too then. Go ahead. And
good afternoon, Chairman Fagan and members of the committee. My name is Charles Edelson, E-D-E-L-S-O-N. I'm the Director of Operations for a tiny, in comparison to some of these other, employment program in Albany. Regrettably, I do have some of the numbers that you folks are interested in. I initially thought I would be commenting only on 2925, but I do have a couple of comments that I think would be constructive as to the other bill as well. With respect to 2925, we support the aspirational goal of the disabled individuals earning something that's more of a living wage, something approaching minimum wage. We are, however, a program that has severe financial constraints. We do hold one of these 14C licenses that you've talked about. For such a tiny program that only employs 40 individuals, we apparently have a disproportionate share of the statewide total, if that 100 number is to be believed. Out of our 40 individuals, 39 make less than minimum wage. The reason the one person does not is that she operates at like 92% efficiency, and based on prevailing wage and the calculations, she beats it. You should understand the background in the DD field. There's been a big push in Employment First. I think you folks have heard quite a bit about that. There's a great deal of incentivizing in the rate structure, pushing programs towards operating in the community rather than being facility-based. There are some constraints on basically getting clients into the facilities at this point. The most common strategy for dealing with that is to somehow shift your facility-based work into being community-based. In our case, we already have a couple community-based programs. We run janitorial and landscaping crews. The facility-based bit has been a shredding crew. We shred confidential documents, but we do it not with the big trucks or the warehouse floors. We do it with smaller machines. But those folks are more severely disabled. Just to give you an idea of what's going on, the folks in the janitorial and landscaping arena are typically working at a productivity in the 40 to 60% range. There's some outliers, higher and lower. With respect to the shredding crew, you're dealing with much lower productivity rates, probably in the range of 3 or 5% up to maybe 20%. Part of what we've done is taken people that would have a really rough go in the community setting and said, look, we're going to try to help you out and give you something to do. They don't make very much money. Their productivity rates are shockingly low, but they are in tandem. You should know, just as a bit of background, that under the 14C scheme, employers that hold these licenses have to conduct time studies to determine employee productivity. Each person is given three trials, each of which is on a different day. They're given credit for their highest output, and then they're re-rated every 6 months. So this is not a once-in-a-lifetime affair. You should also know that a fair proportion of our workers, especially in the shredding crew, are over 50. I'd say it's more than half. We have one guy who's 79 who claims he's going to work until he's 100. The concept of retirement has utterly no meaning to him. I would note that 2925 imposes a requirement of a minimum wage be paid to all these individuals regardless of productivity. And it sounds like a great idea. It is absolutely unfunded. In a program such as ours, it would cost us $9,000 a month to pay the 40 individuals all at minimum wage. We're already losing money. Losing money at that accelerated pace simply puts us out of business. you could probably calculate how many months we would last. It would probably be on the order of 3 or 4. At that point, we shut down. These people go back to their apartments at group homes, nothing to do. They might be able to get on at other programs, but it's questionable. It's also worth noting that some of the folks came to our program from other programs where they were making minimum wage. They chose ours because they liked it better. They valued other attributes of employment more than simply their wage. With respect to 3248, I did not prepare to address that today. We just looked it up while you folks were working on other things. But I have a couple of notes for you. First of all, the scope of this bill exceeds the scope of Senate Bill 555 in two major ways. First of all, 555 only applies to employees that are working on the particular QRF contract under consideration. It does not affect the balance of the workers in the facility. 3248 does. It says all workers of any organization that holds a QRF contract must be paid minimum wage. In our case, our janitorial crews are primarily doing QRF work. And there's no particular provision in this law for hiking up the amount of the contract. You may, in fact, be able to do it. But all the other people would be affected by this with no balancing of the contract provisions for them. And when you start talking about the shredding crew at these fantastically low productivity levels, you're talking about increasing their wages by a factor of, you know, 5 to 20 with no change in their productivity whatsoever, and we have no way to recoup it. The second thing I would note about 3248 is instead of taking everybody up to a minimum wage, it takes them up to a prevailing wage. So it does more. It goes further. So those are my comments. Gladly take any questions at any point.
Just very quickly, you said since you had the numbers, so can you give us the info on kind of what you're going to –
okay.
Those shredding employees, kind of what do they make per hour?
I don't have the exact numbers, but it's going to be working out to be really low. So the more adept people are going to be making on the order of $1 to $1.50 an hour. The less adept, you're probably talking about 25 cents an hour.
And then
that work, by the way, is piece rate. And so you have to work backwards. And make comparisons to what a non-disabled person is able to achieve in the same time period. But it gets you to that end point.
And then did you also have information on your kind of executive salaries?
I can tell you mine. I am the second most highly paid person in the organization. I make $60,000 a year. My boss makes more than I do, but I don't know the exact number. We are probably the only two people that you would consider executives in nature. The organization employs a total of 13 staff, and that includes direct care workers. And we have about 40 disabled people at any one time.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Rayfield.
Yeah, I just wanted to know a little bit more about the shredding process. So how big are the shredders?
We have two kinds. We have one that's probably vintage 1980 to 90. It's a freestanding unit. It's probably the size of this lectern and perhaps 3 feet wide. And you hand feed papers. And if you try to feed more than about 2 pages at a time, it's likely to jam. And you got to remove all the staples. And so the rate at which work is performed is relatively slow. But the comparisons, again, are to a non-disabled person using the same machine. We recently acquired some new machines. We're going mobile. These are slightly smaller. They're like, I think, 17 by 17 and about 30 inches tall. They have the capacity to shred up to 20 pages at a time and about 11 or 12 batches per minute, and you don't have to deal with paper clips, staples, or CDs.
And how many shredding machines do you have?
We have 4 of the old and 4 of the new. compared to the trucks that you see floating around, we're really slow.
And yeah, one last follow-up. How many hours at a time do these folks work in the shredding?
It's varied. I think you'll find that the customary shift in the DD field, and I apologize, I keep forgetting to reply to the chairman and vice chair, but the customary shift in the DD field is on the order of 4 hours. Because of some recent rate changes, the state is in some ways now encouraging that be 5 hours. In our facility, on the shredding situation, everybody takes a very big break sort of in the middle. And when we have sufficient paper to keep people busy, they're probably doing it for a total of about 3 to 3.5 hours per day.
Other questions? All right, Nikki, go ahead.
Okay. Chair Fagan and members of the committee, thank you for your time today. My name is Terry Marsh. I'm the Employment Services Director for Shangri-La. I'm here specifically talking about House Bill 2925. We're concerned about the impact of minimum wage on individuals with the most severe disabilities. Of all the bills that are out there right now, we do think that House Bill 2925 is the least harmful. Shangri-La employs people with disabilities in a number of businesses. Some of those are under QRF contracts, and some of them are private contracts. We also actively support people in pursuing, obtaining, and retaining competitive integrated employment. I know you've heard different things about all the movements going on. Over the years, we've participated in working very closely with vocational rehabilitation, as well as our counties and the state, in working towards optimum employment opportunities for people with disabilities. We originally designed our businesses as training opportunities for people with disabilities. They weren't designed for long-term employment. They were training opportunities. Although many of the people that we support in those businesses now have worked at those same jobs for many years because they don't want to leave until they're 100 years old either. But there have also been many people who've gone on from those training opportunities to work in other businesses in the community at competitive employment rates. But they were able to get the training that they needed for the length of time that they needed and able to move on, and I think that's really important. We do also hold a 14C certificate, which allows us to pay people commensurate wage based on productivity. Heard about how highly regulated that is from Department of Labor. We're audited regularly. We participate with BOLI and DAS and everybody else who regulates all of these things that we do. But the certificate allows us to employ people who might not have the opportunity to try something that they're interested in and gain those skills and then move on. So we're participating in Oregon's Employment First policy. We're following the governor's executive order, and we're dealing with recent changes in service payments to incentivize individualized competitive employment. And we support these changes, and we support this movement, and we're actively participating in it. Right now, capacity for all these changes isn't here in the state. There's many providers and many QRFs who are actively moving forward, but we're just not ready to get everybody into those jobs right now. People aren't trained and able to get out there and make those connections in the community. I just wanted to clarify some of the unintended consequences that might result from House Bill 2925 as it relates to QRFs and our contracts. Currently, we contract with many public agencies, and they purchase goods and services through the QRF program as required by the Products of the Individuals with Disabilities Law. Still, many other public agencies have found ways to get around the law. If we were able to continue to employ the majority of the people who work on our Shangri-La contracts that are not at a competitive rate, most of our people are around an average of 40% productivity. we would have to increase the costs of our contracts. And we believe that those substantial increases would increase the number of public agencies that would find ways to not contract with us. Right now, we have state price agreements for some products, safety vests and air filters. They're already priced higher than people can purchase from China or other areas. Agencies are required to purchase from us through those state price agreements. Many of them are able to independently use their credit cards. If a charge is under $5,000, they can go out and purchase wherever. We have a lot of people doing that, a lot of agencies. And we're pretty sure that increased prices would encourage that behavior. As that happens, then we lose contracts and we would end up losing workers. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges that we're facing. And so if our contracts and purchases shrink, our businesses will shrink, and we're going to be eliminating those vital jobs and training opportunities for people with disabilities. Be happy to answer any questions.
Actually, and thank you very much. Before we ask any questions, I'm going to have Deborah Houston come up because she's our last. That way we'll get that testimony on the record, and then we'll direct questions to this panel.
Chair Fagan and members of the chair, I'm Deborah Houston with Portland Habilitation Center, and I'm an interim CEO. We have over 600 employees who work for us. The majority of them we're represented by three unions, so the majority of them are getting union wages and benefits. We are in favor of House Bill 29. To the degree we have 23 individuals that are still getting a 14C at our facility, this law would protect them to still be able to get a 14C as long as they work in our facility. And we think that's important to this group of individuals. We have chosen to focus years ago on training. We have training for all our business lines that we have in janitorial, in landscaping, in shredding, in administration services. We pay people when they go through the training, minimum wage when you're in training. And then at the end of training, we look at the individual has a choice if they want employment in the community or if they need employment in our jobs that we have set aside under the QRF programs. So we have focused instead of on 14C and paper week, we decided it is a burden, and it's too big of a burden, that we'd rather focus on equipment, modern equipment, technology that helps move people forward and bring up their productivities. We have large scrubbers. We have machinery we train people in. The machinery helps bring the productivity up to a level that we are allowed to pay union wages on. But it does not work for some of the severely disabled in our activity center that we support. And those activity centers do get the 14C. And to those individuals who talk to me, getting a paycheck is everything to them. When I go to work, I have Susan who comes to me and says, today's payday. It's not about the check and the size of the check. It's about Susan is participating in what we all do. She gets a check, and it's a big thing for her to have a paycheck. And that is the group that this bill, we feel, helps protect, and we encourage we're in favor of House Bill 2925. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel, Representative Holby?
Thanks. I've been trying to figure out how, you know, you've mentioned the governor's executive order, and, you know, there's also other legal issues going on around 14C, and also at the federal level, you know, where there's direction on federal contracts that are, you know, requiring minimum wage, I believe. And so though you all are, you know, saying that we're in compliance with all of that, how are you moving towards the future? I mean, I can sort of see some of it, but I'm wondering what's your trajectory for complying with all that in the future? Because it seems like, you know, the 14C may become something of the past. And so I guess what's your business plan to move away from that model to the future? I guess that's, you know, and I know things need to move incrementally, but, you know, I just wonder what those increments are in each of your businesses.
I can go ahead and start. Well, as I mentioned, the governor's executive order and Employment First, and we actually have a strategic plan to move totally towards competitive employment for people. There's a number of different factors at work in Oregon where things are continue to change around what's compliant with the executive order, what's compliant with our Oregon administrative rules. So all of those things aren't in alignment yet, but our pathway is to move forward into allowing people to have job shadows and volunteer experiences and move forward into building community connections and having jobs that pay minimum wage or better. It's
so
not going to happen overnight.
Right, right.
Right.
But that is.
And we don't want to leave people behind. That's probably the biggest thing for me in my role, is that we have a number of people who have worked for 30 years and enjoy their jobs and don't, I mean, they're very frightened about the possibility of leaving the jobs that they're in now. So we want to have a glide path for people, whether it's into retirement or whether it's into competitive employment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. We will continue on the path we're on, but continue with working with training and looking at accommodations and how we can do that. Looking at single tasks people are able to perform. Maybe they can't do the wide array of tasks, but they can do a single task that the productivity is at a level that we can pay above minimum wage. We are still very much concerned. There is a group, and it's an older group, and for us it's 23, that is an activity-based that we would shift into. It's a day program. And those individuals, we've talked to them, would look at doing arts and crafts or other types of things, and it would turn into a day program. That's a little bit harsh because they like the paycheck. We have even talked about figuring a way of, it's not a paycheck, but a way to where we compensate them just so they get the sense of a paycheck beyond that. We are also concerned about the group of individuals who aren't. We do feel there will be a group of people left behind, and we're not happy with that. We do feel there is still a need for a 14C. Even if it goes away, that puts a heavier burden on us on how we do accommodate that and how we do try to reach out and work constantly on productivity and how we can accommodate those people. We're stuck in the middle. If you're in business, you got to have productivity and things to be competitive. The other hand, our mission says, no, create work because we want to employ people with more people with disabilities. We work on productivities. We buy the large shredders. We buy the big equipment. Now I have someone with a disability who can be efficient and be efficient at that task. That's what makes all the difference for us. Let the machinery do the work, and I train the person on the machinery and the capability of that machinery. That helps bring the productivity up. Instead of getting a piece of an old slow-speed buffer and say, well, I've got more man hours because he's on a slow-speed buffer, I'm going to get him a riding buffer. I have an individual who cannot walk that spends 8 hours vacuuming, sitting on a machine at the airport, doing the carpets. That is a machine that is able to accommodate his disability that brings him up to a productivity level that makes him successful. We will continually look at that realm, even at the 14C, but that's a burden we're always looking at. How do we get down to those details to make people successful?
Finally, Chair Fagan and Representative Holvey, our program's in pretty dire straits. We've frankly been rocked by the changes of the last couple of years. We are struggling to keep even with them and stay afloat, and you'd get seasick trying to look very far into the future. So I do not have a satisfactory answer for you.
Thank you very much, panel. Appreciate it. And then final word, Senator Gelser, do you want to come up and close us out?
Thank you, Chair Fagan, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Senator Sarah Gelser from Senate District 8, which includes the Mid-Valley. So we had a hearing yesterday on a bill that was very similar that talks about this issue related to the minimum wage. And I just wanted to put a couple of quick things on the record. The state of Vermont has no 14C certificates and no sheltered workshops. 80% of the people who were employed in the sheltered workshops in Vermont went on to get work in competitive environments at and oftentimes above the minimum wage. The other 20% were able to access quality and satisfactory other meaningful day programs during the day. As a result of those changes in Vermont, 38% of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities in Vermont are employed in competitive workplaces. That's twice the national average. So we can look at the state of Vermont and see that as scary as it is to make a transition, that transition works because we're investing in the things that work, in technology that works to make people efficient, and the training that works to make people skilled to go out and work in the environment. Transitions are always scary. These are the same fears we had with the closure of Fairview. And then I would just close on the issue of minimum wage, because as I said the other day, I believe it's a principle. A minimum wage is a minimum wage. Everyone is entitled to it. And this comes from the State Department of Labor website, History of the Minimum Wage. FDR said this the night before he signed the minimum wage in one of his fireside chats. FDR, do not let any calamity-howling executive with an income of $1,000 a day tell you that a wage of $11 a week is going to have a disastrous effect on all American industry. And then the Department of Labor website goes on to say, in light of the social legislation, Americans today may be astonished that a law with such moderate standards could have been thought so revolutionary. We have the chance here today to make progress, to say that no one deserves to make 25 cents an hour working on outdated machinery. This should not be a revolutionary idea. We have determined that we believe that Americans deserve a minimum wage. People with disabilities are Americans and Oregonians, and they too should access a minimum wage. So thank you for devoting so much time to this discussion.
Thank you, Senator. All right, with that, I'm going to close the public hearings on House Bill 2925 and House Bill 3248. And colleagues, very quickly, we are going to do the work session on. So if you do leave, please try to leave quietly, because we're going to do a work session on House Bill. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2716. We have a dash six amendment. Do you want to summarize the dash six?
Madam Chair and members, the dash six amendment deletes several requirements relative to verifying compliance of contractors and by obtaining documentation from the Oregon Business Development Department. It also makes an exception for emerging small businesses that no longer qualify because of growth in employees or gross receipts. And the bill has been found to have no revenue impact, and it may have a fiscal impact.
Right, we have to give up the room in 3 minutes, Representative, so be quick.
Be very quick. Chair Fegan, members of the committee, I'm Lou Frederick, House District 43, North and Northeast Portland. Thank you for bringing this dash six amendment there. It incorporates a number of the amendments that we requested to clarify the intent. The biggest thing that it removes the prescriptions for documentation and investigation in order to verify continued compliance with the requirements in the bill. And that's to reduce the administrative costs and barriers, preserves the core concept of changing this from a strictly complaint-driven process to one that holds contractors accountable for commitments they make, but without prescribing how that verification will take place. And it makes some changes in language to conform to existing law. You heard that it exempts the emerging small businesses so that they, if they cease to be emerging due to growth, they're not affected by this in terms of the term of the contract. And it clarifies that subcontractors and the contracts under which they operate are also covered. I believe these changes improve the bill, clarifying it, addressing implementation concerns, and most importantly, preserving the core concept that motivated me to bring it to you in the first place. I urge you to adopt the dash six amendment to House Bill 2716 and pass it to the floor if you can with the due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you. I'll entertain a motion.
Yeah, Madam Chair, I move to adopt House Bill 2716-6 amendments dated March 9th, 2015.
Representative Rayfield has so moved. Is there any discussion? Any opposition to the dash six amendments? Okay, seeing none, they're adopted.
Madam Chair, I move House Bill 2716 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Rayfield so moves. Any discussion?
Oh, yes. You know, I very much appreciate Representative Frederick for bringing this forward and bringing this to our attention. I personally still have some concerns about the bill as far as an already complicated system for contractors and so forth, and I feel like this doesn't fully resolve some of the issues he brought forward while complicating the system a little bit more. But I appreciate very much the concerns that you're bringing forward, so I'm going to be a no moving forward. But that doesn't mean that that it's not a worthy discussion.
Thank you, Representative. Further discussion? Okay, seeing none, please call the roll.
Representative Colby?
Aye.
Representative McLean?
Yes.
Representative Neerman?
Yes.
Representative Stark?
No.
Vice Chair Bieber?
No.
Vice Chair Rayfield?
Yes.
And Chair Fagan?
Yes. All right, with that, Representative Frederick, I'm assuming you want to carry the bill?
Would, please. Thank
All
you.
Right, so Representative Frederick will carry it. With that, I'm going to close the work session House Bill 2716 and close the House Consumer Protection Government Effectiveness Committee.